speaker, Tina A. from Long Beach, California.
Tina Albert, alcoholic. I am super grateful to be here and to be sober tonight. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you here. This is absolutely the best thing that has ever happened to me in my entire life. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. So play with me just for a second. If you're new here in your first maybe year of sobriety, will you raise your hands for me? Awesome. I want to welcome you here, and I want to thank you for volunteering to be on next year's committee. Excuse me. I got a frog in my throat. So, David, thank you so much for asking me to come and be here with you guys this weekend. It is always an honor and a privilege to be asked to do anything in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it absolutely takes just a certain level of incredible self-centeredness to enjoy this kind of thing. So, never in my wildest drunken dreams, you guys, would I think like that this would be me. And it's funny because sometimes I get calls and I'm asked to come and share my experience, strength, and hope in different places. And I always giggle, maybe not loud where they can hear me, but I always giggle when I get the phone call. And then normally I tell them, "Are you sure you didn't mean to call my friend Tammy? I'm Tina." I'm Tina A. from Torrance, so apparently that's the problem. Like, they meant to call Tina from Long Beach, and you guys are stuck with me tonight, so I apologize. But I love this deal. I love this deal, and thank you so much, Tina, for hosting me this weekend. Today is her 11th anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous. What is that? What is that? And you've done a great job, and you're my new sister, and I'm incredibly stoked to get to be here with you guys this weekend. And the committee's done just a seamless job. I know it is an incredible amount of work that you guys put into this, from the smallest commitment to the largest. Like, everything has its own place in the wheel that has something like this go off, and I applaud you for your commitment and your hard work, and everything has been seamless. So you guys have done a phenomenal job. And I flew in yesterday, and I feel like it's always funny, like, you come someplace where you don't know anybody and you feel like ill at ease and a little bit uncomfortable and you don't know anybody, and by a couple hours in, like, I feel like we're family, like I belong here, and I feel comfortable in your midst. And that was never ever the case for me before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so incredibly grateful. So I get to share with you guys in a general way, right? Thank God for that. What I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I can tell you that long before I ever picked up a drink of alcohol, I was in desperate need of one. I was restless, irritable, and discontented from the time that I could remember. Quite frankly, I think the day that I was born, the doctor should have smacked my mom instead of me. There was something incredibly wrong with me from the time that I can remember. I was raised in this little upper middle class beach community in Southern California called Manhattan Beach. And I went to school with all of these little girls that were 5 feet tall, and they all had long flowing blonde hair and these sparkly little blue eyes and these pretty little surfer chick tans, and they all looked like little prepubescent Pamela Andersons. I mean, they were just perfect. And I was 5'8" when I was in the seventh grade. I had long stringy reddish hair, buck teeth, and freckles. And so I would look at these little girls, and I saw perfection. And then I would look in the mirror, and I felt like Pippi Longstocking on crack. Like, something incredibly wrong with me. And I remember going to school in the seventh grade, and we had to change into our PE uniforms, and then we had to work out and do our little PE thing, and then we had to shower and get back into our regular clothes. And I would go into the locker room with these little girls. They all had like little lacy undies and these little matching training bras, and my training bra fit better when I put it on backwards. That's not funny. I mean, just something wrong with me, you guys. And my best friend in junior high, her name was Carrie. She was my best friend because she was Italian and her teeth were bigger than mine were. I've been seeking lower companions my whole life. And Carrie decided that we were going to go to her house and we were going to cut school and drink scotch. And halfway through my seventh grade year, we ditched school one day. We went to her house and dove into a fifth of scotch, and my drinking career could have been written that day. I drank straight out of the bottle. We had no glass, no ice, no mixer, and I hated scotch. Are there any scotch drinkers in here? I know why you guys are in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, woo, that's vile. And I remember that first drink like it was yesterday. It burnt all the way down, and it burnt all the way up, and it burnt when it came flying out my nose. It was vile, nasty, horrible stuff, and I didn't want to drink any more of it. And I watched my friend Carrie, and she started giggling, and her face got pink, and she wasn't afraid of getting in trouble for cutting school, so I took that scotch bottle and I started chugging so I could catch up with her. And in short order, I puked all over her living room. I don't think we talk about puking enough in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a lost art form, if you ask me. But I threw up all over her living room. I have large memory gaps throughout the course of that afternoon. Oh, I love that. I learned something new. shoot, now I forgot where I was and I have to start all over again. Wait, what are you doing over there? But I remember about noon the school had called my mom because I was absent, and she came banging on Carrie's door, and we jumped out Carrie's bedroom window, climbed over the back, I can't look at her anymore, climbed over the backyard fence, and I was off on Pippi's first grand adventure. I want to know how you do Pippi. Oh, my God, aren't they awesome, you guys? And, okay, look this way. So we were climbing over these backyard fences. I was running through your backyards and hiding in your doghouses, and I was running from the cops, and they weren't even chasing me. I had so much fun that afternoon. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I knew I couldn't go home because I was in trouble, so I stole a bicycle from the continuation school with no seat on it, and that's why they didn't have it locked up. You guys, but oh my goodness, I felt so incredibly different on the inside, you guys, that I had to dress up the outsides so that it would match. Like, if my insides were odd and the outsides looked okay, nothing reconciled. It didn't seem like it made any sense to me, and so I was doing this Pippi Goes Chola phase. I don't know if you have those here in Hawaii, but I'm crying. But I have this reddish hair, like in this Aquanet pitchfork. I ratted it way up high, and I'm scared. I'm afraid. And I had this black eyeliner, and I was wearing these Dickie pants and these little collared shirts and these little crip slips, and I was running all over Redondo Beach scribbling La Flaca R13. All over the walls in pencil, and and I stole this bicycle from the continuation school, and I put my friend's 9-year-old brother on the handlebars, because I'm not one of those get in trouble by yourself kind of girls. I gotta take you with me so you absorb half of it, and I put this little 9-year-old boy on the handlebars, and we ran away from home because it seemed like the only answer that I could come up with. And at 11 o'clock, I had pedaled us all the way up to East L.A., where La Flaca didn't fit in too well. And I called the police, and they came and picked us up, and my mom picked me up from the police department, and she was devastated. And I was maybe 13 years old. And for the next 7 years, you guys, I drank myself into and out of everything that I loved and that mattered to me in my life. Like, I had goals and aspirations, and I loved to dance. I used to take tap and jazz and ballet, and it was my dream to be a dancer. And I started drinking, and I couldn't go to dance class anymore, and I couldn't go to recitals, and nothing mattered to me. And I gotta tell you guys, as much as I hated that drink of alcohol, I absolutely loved the effect that I got from that drink of alcohol. Like, it fixed absolutely everything that was broken about me. It was almost like it filled all the cracks in my soul. You know what I mean? And I took that drink, and my hair straightened, and my teeth shrunk, and my boobs grew. And, like, everything... Everything that I thought was broken about me just seemed to melt into the background, and I loved the effect that I got from that drink of alcohol. And my friend Peg says that she used to drink, and she used to feel wittier, prettier, and tittier. And I, how do you do that one? I absolutely know what she meant. Goodness. Okay. just to fast forward, because I only have like an hour and 35 minutes left. I'm just kidding. Calm down. I drank myself into and out of middle school and Maricosta High School and Pacific Shores Continuation School. And when I was halfway through my 10th grade year, I had no credits, and I took the California High School Proficiency Exam. My counselor called my mom in and suggested that I take this test because there was no way that I was going to graduate from high school. And I took this test, and I passed it with flying colors, and I went off to El Camino College when I was 16 years old. I'm that girl in the 12 and 12 that thinks that I can float above the rest of you on my brain power alone. And I went to college when I was 16 years old, and I did the same thing there that I did in high school. I drank and got loaded before first period. I left campus before I got in trouble. All my classes were incomplete or drops or Fs or whatever, and I would show up to class, and my professors would look at me like, and I would tell him, like, I'm in this class, but I'd never been there, so how would he know that? And so I stopped going to that school, and I was running away on a continuous basis. I was 16 years old and then 17 years old, and my mom wanted me to do ridiculous things, like come home at night and whatever. And I would run away, and I would be gone for weeks at a time, and my mom would be hiring these little private investigators trying to find out if her only daughter was dead or alive, and I was just off doing my thing, and I'd get tired and call her up with that alcoholic arrogance, like, are you ready to let me come home now? And she would let me back into her house, and I would do the same thing again, and When I was 17 years old, I was working at a Burger King because it was the best I could do. I had a very technical position. I was the drive-through technician. And I was hanging out the window one day, and my friends would come through the drive-through, and I would give them free food, and then they in turn would give me free things. So I was hanging out the window doing free things, and I turned around, and there was a United States Marine standing at the cash register in his dress blue uniform. And I don't know about the rest of you ladies, maybe a few of you gentlemen in here too. I love a man in uniform, right? There's something about a Marine Corps dress blue uniform that is like none other. And I lived according to the principle, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, long before y'all came up with that idea. And so I gave this man my phone number, and he started calling me at stupid hours, like 10 o'clock in the morning. I went down to his office one day to find out what he wanted, and it turns out that he was a United States Marine Corps recruiter. Just in case you guys don't know this, their sole intent is to recruit you into the United States Marine Corps. And I spun this really sad tale of woe about why I was 17 years old with a proficiency certificate and working at Burger King. And I found out quickly that Sergeant Dale Starkey had no intention whatsoever of recruiting me into his United States Marine Corps. They take that stuff kind of personal. He did, however, take me next door to the United States Navy office. And I got off this bus on the 21st day of December in 1981. I was drunk from the plane ride cross country. I had all of our service jackets because I was in charge. There were all these girls that I was giving liquor on the plane. I was stealing it out of the flight attendant's cart and passing out the little bottles. And we were all hammered and we're getting off this bus and we're singing "In the Navy." And they're grabbing my stuff and screaming at me. And I thought, like, in the morning, as soon as I could speak with whomever is in charge, I'd be able to explain the nature of the mistake that they had made, and they would let me go home. And Navy boot camp doesn't work that way, just in case you've never been. I stayed in Navy boot camp. I was the youngest kid in my company. It was, 6 months after my 17th birthday, I was in trouble all the time. I just couldn't do what they wanted me to do. And they would say, "Do this, this way." And I would come up with a better idea. And they don't like that. I had my first captain's mask, which is like court if you've never been in the military. For a drink in 5 weeks enlisted during my work week, I met my commanding officer because I drank a six-pack of beer in boot camp, and they frown on that. I almost got kicked out in boot camp, and I had my second captain's mask 5 months enlisted in Pensacola, Florida, for drinking on a duty weekend and leaving base when I wasn't supposed to. This time they sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was 17 years old, and I would go into these little A&A meetings, and I would listen to you guys talk, and I went to this Navy Alcohol Safety Awareness Program. This time I lost a stripe and half my pay for about a month, I got set back. I was 14 days in the restricted barracks, and I graduated with the class after mine. And while I was in the restricted barracks, all of my top secret special intelligence security clearances came through because I was enlisted to be in naval intelligence, which should frighten you just a little. I was going through that school. I was top in my class before I got in trouble, and I had orders to go to the Pentagon when I graduated from school, and I got in trouble for drinking one more time, and I spent that time in the restricted barracks, and they yanked my orders, and they sent me to my first duty station, which was Adak, Alaska. Nobody's been there. But it's this little ice-covered rock off the Kamchatka Strait in Russia, that's where they sent you in 1982 if you were in naval intelligence, because we were spying on Russia, and I was secretary to the commanding officer in the naval security group, every piece of classified intelligence that we got from Russia would come across my desk, and I would type it up, then I'd go to the EM club on my lunch break and have a couple Long Island iced teas, and then I would come back and start disseminating this classified information to the wrong people at the wrong commands. They don't much care for that either, and I gotta tell you guys, I loved being in the military. I make a lot of jokes about it because it was fun and it was funny or whatever, but I loved serving my country. I loved wearing my uniform. I loved working. I loved working for the commanding officer of that naval security group. I loved everything about being in the military. The only problem was they started wanting to regulate my drinking, and by this time, I'm, like, completely out of control. And they sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous one more time, and they put me on Anabuse. And I'm going to these little AA meetings. I'm 17 years old. There's six little guys in these meetings, and they're talking about God only knows what. And what I swear to God I heard them say is, kid, you got a problem with alcohol. Like, people have been telling me that my whole life. Like, oh, my God, kid, you got a problem with alcohol. And when I hear you tell me that, I know that you cannot possibly understand the nature of my problem, because my problem is not alcohol. My problem has never been alcohol. I have a huge problem with the consequences surrounding my drinking, but alcohol, no, truthfully, alcohol is the only solution that I have ever known in my entire life. Like, every single time that I feel like I cannot breathe, I take a drink of alcohol and my shoulders drop. And that crick in my neck goes away, and I'm able to take a nice, long, deep breath and exhale, and, like, absolutely everything is okay just for a little while. And I even know by this time that I'm going to drink and I'm going to get in a lot of trouble, and I really don't want to do that, but I know that it's inevitable, and there's nothing that I can do about it, but I don't think that booze is my problem. And so when that's what I hear you tell me, I don't think your solution can possibly work for me. And, So I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm taking this Anabuse, and my best friend, who just happened to be on Anabuse also, whatever, decided that we were going to drink Heineken. And I drank half a Heineken and puked for 6 solid hours, and I was afraid I was going to die, and then I was afraid I wasn't. And I showed up to my counselor's office the next day with this splotchy rash all over my face that I tried to explain away as the chicken pox, because I'm a quick thinker. And And he just looked at me with that look, right? And in these AA meetings, they're asking me ridiculous questions like, do you ever have complete memory lapses as a result of your drinking? And I tell them, like, everybody that I know has those. That's whiskey. And they say that everybody you know is an alcoholic. And I think you guys are just dumb. That's what you are. You're just dumb. And then they say stuff like, do you ever wake up in strange places with strange people and not know how you got there? And I tell them, I'm a United States Navy sailor. Like, duh. Really? Of course I do that. It's in my job description, really. Fairly certain I signed something. And they just asked me these questions, and I don't get it. And I got incredibly sick drinking on that Anabuse. A couple weeks later, I started thinking I've been on Anabuse for a little while, and I'm certain my body's acclimated, and maybe if I had, like, Coors Light, because that's really almost water anyway, I would be able to just have a drink. I hate it when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. Oftentimes today, I hear people go, like, just don't drink no matter what. And I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I just drink no matter what. Like, when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you tell me just don't drink no matter what, like, that's not a sufficient substitute for me. When you take booze away from me, my real problem seems to start about 72 hours away from my last drink, when I absolutely cannot stand the way that I feel. And I hate the things that I think, and I don't like the way that I feel, and I can't stand you, and I really can't stand me, and I burn with a guilt and a shame and a remorse that nothing will extinguish but a drink of Jack Daniel's whiskey or a couple of Long Island iced teas. And I drink, you guys, until I absolutely can't drink anymore, until something physically separates me from alcohol, and then I stay stopped as long as I can possibly stand it, and then I drink again. And I have had the audacity to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with 5 and 10 and 15 years sober and watch people come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would think to myself and sometimes verbalize, as much as I'm ashamed to admit it, what is wrong with you? Like, you are sitting right in the middle of the frickin' answer, and look at you. Here you are drunk again. And I went through the big book one more time and read in our doctor's opinion, where Dr. Silkworth talks about alcoholism and drinking, and he says that this is repeated over and over again, that unless we can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of our recovery. And I truly believe, to the very core of my being, that if you're new here tonight with one day, or you're the old timer in here with 50 or 60 years, we're the blessed ones, you guys. We are so blessed. We are so blessed. And There's a line in our big book that talks about alcoholism, and it says, with it goes the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. And I looked up that word just because I wanted to make sure I understood what it meant after I got sober. And annihilation means to reduce to nothing. And I had reduced to nothing everything that I loved in my life by the time that I came to you. But on that island, I drank on Anabuse for the second time. I decided that I was going to have just a shot of Jack Daniels in case the Coors Light didn't work, so I'd catch a buzz just in case I threw up. And I had a seizure and woke up in the emergency room of the Naval Hospital on that island. And I spent 14 days in the psychiatric unit in Anchorage, because when you drink on Anabuse the second time, the Navy thinks it's grave emotional and mental disorders. And so they sent me over there, and I spent a couple weeks in the psych unit, came back with a recommendation that I'd be discharged. I begged my CO for another shot. He sent me to rehab in Philadelphia. I drank on Anabuse for the third time at a Phillies game on Sunday in the middle of that rehabilitation program, and spray puked 5 rows of Philly Stadium because I'm a lady when I drink. And I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they boot me out of that rehab and send me over to the Naval Station to wait for my separation. And I told my counselor, I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to ask this beast named Alice to be my sponsor, because I was listening in your meetings. And I was going to do whatever it took. I would take your Anabuse. I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I would go back into the rehab. I'd go back into the nut ward. Like, I'll do anything. Just please don't take away my career. I love serving my country. And my counselor goes, that's good, kid, but if you ever want to get sober, call Alcoholics Anonymous. You won't. You'll die drunk. And you guys could have hooked me up to a polygraph, and I would have passed with flying colors. Like, I was not going to drink that day. I was going to do whatever it took to save my military career. And by noon, I was at the EM Club kitchen quarters and drinking beer on Anabuse for the fourth time. Left to my own devices, you guys, I absolutely do not have what it takes to not pick up a drink of alcohol. I can't. No matter how great the necessity or the wish, I just drink. And I hear oftentimes in Alcoholics Anonymous that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. It's my personal opinion, you guys, that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, knowing precisely what's going to happen. I know that I'm going to pick up that drink of alcohol because I cannot not pick up that drink of alcohol. And I'm more than likely going to drive my car because I need to go somewhere when I'm drinking alcohol. And there's a good possibility that I'm going to injure myself or somebody else while I'm driving that vehicle. And there's a good possibility that I'm going to wake up in jail and not remember how I got there. I might wake up with your husband or your wife. Don't judge, you guys have done that too. I do stuff that I would never, ever do. Never, ever do in a sober state of mind. And I'll do absolutely whatever it takes so that I can get another drink. And I burned my life to the ground. I got out of the military in July of 1983. And I would have told anybody that was listening, I'm too young to be an alcoholic. I'm only 18 years old. I've never been to jail. I've not had any drunk drivings at that time. I've not lost any jobs. I don't know what I thought the Navy was. It's not just a job. It's an adventure. But you guys are old, and you've lost families and children and wives and husbands, and you've done all of this stuff. And I haven't done any of that. I just drink a little bit too much. And maybe one day when I get like you guys, I'll come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the next 15 months, I did every single thing that I swore I would never, ever do that separated me from you guys. And I did those things over and over and over again. On the 10th day of October in 1984, I was living in a 1971 MG Midget. I used to like to call it my roundabout townhouse, because when it would run, it would get me roundabout town. And when it didn't, I just park it somewhere. And I had been homeless for almost a year. I went to my mom's house, and I put my hands on my little 5'1" mother in an inappropriate fashion while I was under the influence of alcohol and some mind-altering chemicals, and I robbed her house, and she told me, you get out of here and don't you ever come back here. My only daughter's dead. I'm an only child. And she threw me out of her house, and she told me never to come back. And for a year, I just lived in that car, and I drank, and I burned my life to the ground. And on the 10th day of October in 1984, I weighed 120 sucked-up pounds. I'm 5'10", so I was a little underweight. I had just enough bile in my hair to pass as highlights, because who could afford a good hairdresser? And of that acrid homeless stench that takes months to wash out of your pores. When I would get too offensive for my own nose, I would go down to the sand showers in Manhattan Beach and I would steal some soap from the grocery store and I'd try and wash up in the showers. And the parents of my friends that I went to high school with would come walking down the Strand and they would look at me with that look on their face like, oh my God, what happened to you? Like, you used to spend the night with my daughter and look at you, look at you. And I would just look at the ground. I was dirty on the inside and I was dirty on the outside and I couldn't make eye contact with you guys and was so ashamed of the woman that I had become. And on the 10th day of October, just like he was sitting in the seat next to me, I heard that little counselor tell me to call Alcoholics Anonymous, but I wouldn't, that I would die drunk. And I called our central office, and they sent me over to this little Olano Club in Hawthorne. I walked into a 5:30 meeting on a Wednesday. The topic was relationships, which was perfect because I was looking for a view. And I had these pants on that were way too tight, and there was a big hole in the back end of them, so I would walk into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all the men would go like this, which was perfect, because I didn't want to look at you in the face. They would just all look at my backside, and I just sat down, you guys. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, oh my goodness, just come on in here and have a seat. Take a load off. Just take a break. Whose phone is that? Do you need me to get that? Hello. I'm so glad we didn't have those when I got sober. I would have lined up four of them and called myself on them. But I'm sorry. No, I'm not. Now I really forgot where I was and I have to start over. So I'm Tina. No. But I walked into that meeting and I just sat down and you guys were so incredibly kind to me. And it didn't make any sense at all. Like, I was smelly and I was dirty and I was dressed inappropriately. And you guys took turns sitting next to me and you brought me coffee a half a cup at a time. And you brought me orange juice and honey because I was starting to get a little bit shaky and I didn't feel good. And I just sat down and I stayed for that meeting and then the 8:30 meeting. And then you guys took me to this fellowship thing that you guys had after the meeting and you bought me a little $1.99 breakfast and you sat with me till 2 o'clock in the morning and then you disappeared. Dirty trick. And I went and parked my car back behind that Olano Club and vibrated until 6 o'clock the next morning. And my friend Gary was the secretary of our 6:45 attitude adjustment meeting. He would come out at 6 o'clock, he bought me a toothbrush and some soap, and he would let me come in and wash up in the bathroom. And then I could eat all the jelly donuts I wanted and drink all the coffee I wanted until you guys got there for your little meetings. And you would come in and I would adjust your attitudes, and then I would send you off to like Northrop and TRW where you worked. And you'd come back at 11:30 for your lunch meeting and your 5:30 commuter meeting, and then you'd bring your little Al-Anonic wives back at 8 o'clock, and we'd have the 8 o'clock meeting, and then we'd do the fellowship thing, and then you'd disappear, and it's like this pathetic Groundhog Day, like over and over and over again. And I went into the club one morning. Gary woke me up in the car back there. I went into the club that morning, and you guys all came in for your little meeting, and you congratulated me on having 30 days sober, and I didn't even know it, but you did. You did, and I didn't even know. And you guys told me to get a sponsor. You told me the men work with the men and the women with the women. The men will pat your ass, and the women will save it. So I asked this guy named Paul Mattson to sponsor me. And he was this eclectic, funky, leftover hippie from the 60s. And he had long gray hair and all this. He wore this carpet purse and he had this bandana and all this turquoise jewelry. And he spoke with this really Shakespearean English accent, even though he was from Inglewood, California. And I asked that man to sponsor me because he was the one person in the room that I believed that I was willing to accept some advice from and follow direction from without argument or question or debate. I would just be willing to do what he asked me to do. And he had this uncanny knack of being able to raise his voice just a little bit louder than the noise in my head. And I loved that man. He was the first principled man in my life that didn't want anything inappropriate from me that I could remember. And I started doing the things that he asked me to do. And he put me into service in Alcoholics Anonymous. He made me your ashtray putter outer person when I was a couple weeks sober. And I would show up early and I would put these ashtrays equally from the ends of the long table so that your osteoarthritic little arms could all hit the ashtrays with your cigarettes. And I forgot to mention, at my home group then, which was called the Southwest Solano Club, everybody in there ranged in age from like 86 to 132. And I was 20. And the young people would come into Birch, the young newcomers, and my old-timers would look at them and they would tell them, "Why don't you guys go down to the Hermosa Beach Alano Club, honey? Because there's lots of young people there and you'll probably fit in. You go down there and you'll love those meetings." And then they would look at me and say, "In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that we don't pronounce anyone alcoholic. But in your case, we're going to make an exception. Sit down. You, sit." And I just sat down. And I was your ashtray putter outer person. And then he took my commitment. I was mad. I didn't want him to take my commitment. He took my commitment, and then he made me your coffee cup washer. And by this time, he's getting cantankerous. So, like, I get up to the podium because I'm young. I've been in the psych unit. I've been to psychiatrists and psychologists and rehab and the nut ward, and I've been to jail, and I got this young people spin on alcoholism that you guys clearly don't have because you sobered up before the frickin' crust of the earth cooled, for crying out loud. And I'm going to explain to you why it's okay that I'm going to talk to you about alcoholic addict and drunk and a junkie and let you guys know that you're detoxing me off of things that you probably can't even pronounce. But it's okay, and I'm going to explain to you why. I get up to the podium and I say, "Tina, alcoholic," and Paul stands up and he goes, "That's all you know. You'll sit down now." And I was like, what? and I would sit down. And then I had 30 days sober and I got up and I'm going to explain some stuff to you. And he starts that sponsor squiggle, which is where I learned to speak so quickly. He stands up, he goes, "You're finished now." And I was like, I look across the room at my old-timers, and I'm like, "Are you going to let him treat me like this? Like, you guys told me let us love you until you can learn to love yourself. Like, that is not love. If you ask me, that is some rude behavior, and you need to shut him down." And you guys are going like this. I was so mad, you guys. I was going to report you to New York. Like, we're going to shut the Alano Club down. We're certainly going to yank his sponsor license. You know what I mean? Because he does not know how to do it. And I was so crushed that I went into the kitchen that evening and I washed the ashtrays and then I washed your ceramic cups in the dirty water when I was finished. Because I was going to show you. And I only did that twice because he made me apologize from the podium and I don't like that. And then he made me your coffee maker, and I would make this rank navy coffee that you had to serve toothpicks with to get the grinds out of your little black teeth. You guys would come vibrating up to me after the meeting going, "Good navy coffee, baby girl." And you'd go stay up until Tuesday. I just wanted to share the experience with you, you know what I mean? And I just learned how to serve you. I learned how to serve you in ridiculous ways that didn't seem to make any sense to me at all, that had no bearing whatsoever to the problems going on in my life. Paul just asked me to do something, and I just said yes, and I did it. And I got to tell you, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, that that's held me in good stead since the 10th day of October in 1984. A couple weeks ago, I celebrated 32 years sober. You should clap for yourselves because you've had to tolerate me for all these years. But I had no intention of coming in here and staying with you guys. I just wanted to take a little break and fix a few things that I had broken and figure out how I could drink some more. Because I could not fathom the idea of never picking up another drink for the rest of my life. One of my old-timers said that, "You never have to pick up another drink for the rest of your life, 24 hours at a time." And I told him, like, "Tom, you only have 3 days left. Like, it's going to be a piece of cake for you." but that's not even the solution that I'm looking for, you know? One of, I believe, the greatest orators in Alcoholics Anonymous ever was Chuck Chamberlain. And I heard a CD of Chuck Chamberlain. He passed away in December of 1984, just a couple months after I got sober. And I heard him, he had this voice, and he used to, I heard him on this CD say that, my obsession to drink went away the moment of my commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. From the time that I committed myself to you, my obsession to drink left me and it's never returned. And I think there's incredible power in that statement. Like, what does it mean to commit myself to Alcoholics Anonymous? Some of our literature talks about making a decision to not drink, and it says that we're going to give it up for good and for all. Like, I think that one day at a time, 24 hours at a time thing, it's a trick you guys do. And I love that trick. I love that trick. Because it's allowed me to stay in here. It's just allowed me to stay. And I love that home group and I love that sponsor. I started working the steps with him and my life started to change. Paul was an atheist / agnostic. He suffered from COPD and asthma and all of these chronic breathing disorders that actually took his life 2 years after I got sober. But we would talk about this God of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't want to hear it. Not because I didn't believe in God, but because I believed that God didn't believe in me. I thought the things that I had done and the places that I had gone disallowed me the privilege of having a relationship with this God that you guys talk to me about ad nauseum. And Paul described himself as an atheist, unless he couldn't breathe really bad, and then he was agnostic. And so we didn't talk a whole lot about God. We talked about substituting Alcoholics Anonymous for the power. And when I was not too long sober, I decided that I was going to turn my will and my life over to the care of Paul Mattson, as I very frequently misunderstood him and the old timers in my home group. And that held me in good stead for a long time. And I did an inventory and I shared things with that man that I didn't think I would ever share with another human being. We looked at defects of character and I decided I'd work on them because there was no power that was going to relieve them from me. And whenever I'm working on a defect, you guys should run far, far away. Because that's not what the step says, but that's the way I interpreted it for a little while. And I made that 8-step list, and I made amends, and I had 2 years sober. I walked up to the club on the 10th day of October in 1986 to take my 2-year cake at the noon meeting, and you guys came out and got stupid close to me in that way that makes me want to throat punch you still today. And you told me that my sponsor had passed away that morning, and I thought I was going to have to leave. I didn't think I could stay with you without him. Like, I loved him so much. I named my son after him. And I got another sponsor, and it was a woman, and every other word out of her mouth was God, and every other word out of mine was God. And Connie sponsored me for a lot of years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had children, and I got married in that order, because whatever, And I was married to the Prince Charming in my fairy tale. It is an incredible gift for me to be here this weekend with you. Your Sunday morning speaker is David. David and I have been friends for many years. And David actually sponsored my husband for a little while, my ex-husband. Spoiler alert. That Chris started spiraling and spinning and doing things that weren't conducive with a sober and spiritual journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, and David sponsored him, and he used to tell him, like, dude, you can't serve two masters. And that turned out to be the case, and it was an incredibly powerful and painful lesson for me to watch, I gotta tell you. But I was married to the Prince Charming in my fairy tale. And we both went to Birch together. I remember I had 6 weeks sober, and I went in there, and we were having our old-timers meeting on the Friday after Thanksgiving. And they arranged all the old-timers up on the stage in their varying stages of decay. My mama Helen was missing her eye, and she had a patch over her eye from cancer, and my sponsor was up there with oxygen and a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, And my friend Bob had a prosthetic limb, and this lady named Helen Louise, she was such a beautiful woman. She got up to the podium, and she was wearing a full-length mink coat and all these diamonds, and she draped herself over the podium, and she looked right at me, and she said, "Wear your sobriety, honey." And I looked down at my little fishnets and hooker heels and thought, like, I am. And they love the Al-Anon women in my home group because they gave me all their Alateens clothing that was too offensive for their teenage daughters to wear. And I would come bebopping in these mini skirts with these low-cut shirts and hooker heels and fishnets. I had that 1980s flash dance hair going on. Hey, I was a vision for you. I think I have it now from the hurricane we set through earlier, but whatever. And I would come bebopping in, and I'd get up and go get coffee and go sit down and go outside and go smoke and talk to you while we're reading stuff. And, I just can't sit down in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I've memorized that crap you're reading. I fail to see why I got to listen to it every freaking meeting. And I stand up one day, and my sponsor puts his hand on my leg, and he shoves me into the chair. He goes, "If you get out of that chair one more time during a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you better have piss dribbling down your leg." And I was like, I can't even believe, and I don't know if that's really what he said. What he probably said was, "Sit down." But that's what I heard, you know what I mean? I came in one day, I was dressed like that, and he goes, "Would you wear that to church?" And I said, "Well, no, sir, I would not, but there's a dance after the meeting." He goes, "I'll be damned if you wear it to mine. Go change your clothing." And I was like, I've never had a man go tell me to put more clothes on in my whole life. I don't even know what you do with that. And I was angry, and I went out to the car, and I put more clothes on, and I'm your stupid greeter, and I don't want you to hug me. You guys walk in, and I punch you in your frail little arms and bruise you because you're on blood thinners. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And glad you're here, Tina. And you go, crawl off into the corner and sit down. And I go outside and change my clothes. You come in, I'm like, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." I'm staring at the ground. I can't look you guys in the face. And after a couple of weeks, I realize you guys walk in, and I'm looking you right in the face, and I'm shaking your hand, and then I'm hugging you, and I'm going "Hi, David, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous," and you're hugging me, and you're going, "Hi, Tina, I'm glad you're here." And I had no idea that by changing my clothes, my sponsor was teaching me how to carry myself with a little bit of dignity and grace, like a sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea that he was physically divorcing me from the view that I had about myself as a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came to you, I thought I had one thing of value, and if I didn't freely give it, you were going to take it, and it's much easier my way. You know what I'm saying? I completely understand the whole idea of men with men and women with women. I get that. But I was willing to listen to that old man. And I watched the women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were a phenomenal example of something that I might try and grow into one day. But the gift that I got from the men in Alcoholics Anonymous is that they demanded that I allow them to treat me like a lady. And I did not know how to do that. And that's not even a lesson that I wanted to learn when I came to you guys. I didn't even know there was a problem with my behavior. And I will be forever grateful to you guys for the life that you've given me. Oh, my goodness. But I had that sponsor, I got married, I had those kids, whatever, we moved up to Northern California, I went to school, I bought houses and cars, we had horses in our backyard and Harleys in the driveway, and I'm living the dream. I'm in Northern California, 17 years sober, I'm the Clancine of the Central Valley in California. I am sponsoring half of Northern California. I float into candlelight meetings. You turn the lights off and I glow in the dark. I'm super sober. You know what I mean? I can count 5 generations of my sponsorship lineage. I don't know what the hell you're talking about in the meeting, but I can count 5 generations of my sponsorship lineage in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm doing the deal. And I make fun of that because it's funny and whatever. But the truth is, I was in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, immersed in the center and serving Alcoholics Anonymous. And I built an incredible life in here. I have these 2 kids, and we bought this house up north and we're riding our Harleys, and I gave my eldest born to the United States Navy because I'm quite creative for my ninth step amend. And a few months enlisted like Matthew's in Iraq. And I went like, wait a minute, I gave him to the Navy because I didn't want him in Iraq, right? And I got a plan, and Matt's in Iraq and I can't get a hold of him, and his dad starts riding with these rather unsavory characters that like to wear red and white death heads on their back. And when I was about 19 years sober, Chris decided that the next step in his spiritual journey was to prospect for the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club. And he rode off into the sunset with a bunch of greasy bikers that I thought at the time were all male. And my little guy was 15 years old, and he was so angry at his father, he started dropping out of school and quitting all the sports teams. And I got a drunken Navy sailor son and a dope fiend high school dropout son, and two parts of my story are coming to life right before my very eyes, and I'm hanging on for all I'm worth, because if you guys will just do what I tell you to, I know I can pull all of this out of the fire. And nobody's listening. And Chris left, and my entire sober world crumbled, you guys. And it's not super sexy to say from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was like 20 years sober in the fetal position in my bedroom, and I couldn't get up. I just couldn't get up, and I couldn't eat, and I didn't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't want to answer the phone. And the girls that I was sponsoring were coming over one at a time, and they were feeding me and making me get in the shower and taking me to meetings whether I wanted to go or not. And we're praying, or they're praying, and I'm listening like, right? I've served this God of Alcoholics Anonymous for 20 years, and this is what I get? Like, forget about it, you know? I'll just fix this myself. And I turn my back on this loving, amazing father that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous and tried to fix my own life. And I was that girl in step two in the 12 and 12, where it talks about faith means reliance, not defiance. And I was filled with this defiance and this self-will run riot, and not willing to listen to anybody and sponsoring myself and doing my own thing. And when I was 21 and a half years sober, I found myself standing on a bridge in Northern California. Because I have bought, you guys, hook, line, and sinker, that I never want to wake up with whiskey on my breath. I never want to drink again for the rest of my life, 24 hours at a time. But I didn't want to do this anymore either. And I had not an answer left. Not an answer left. And I was standing on a bridge thinking, like, that certainly looks like the easier, softer way. And I said one of those foxhole prayers to a God that I didn't even believe in anymore, and I asked him for help. And not under my own steam, I can assure you, I walked off that bridge and I went to one more meeting. And I read one more page out of the big book, and I answered one more phone call, and I did one more inventory, and most of them were even mine. I went to one more meeting, and I said one more prayer. You guys said pray for that man. I prayed for him every day for 30 days, and he never once burned up in a house fire. So I was relatively certain that it was not working, and I just did what you guys taught me how to do when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I walked through, God, the most painful period in my life. Like, I didn't think I could do that. And you guys one more time surrounded me, and you held me so close. Like, you guys have always held me up when my knees have failed to do the job. And I started to rebuild my life. And I called this cantankerous old man that works at a mission in downtown Los Angeles, and I go like, help? And he goes, Tuesday 11:30, my office, kid. And I drove 400 miles from Hollister, California, down to the Midnight Mission on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles, and I sat across the table from Clancy, and I asked him to help me. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, those are the most powerful words that you can ever, ever utter, like, will you please help me? And what that means for me is that I am at the absolute end of my own human resources. Like, I don't have another answer left, and I'm willing to do anything that you tell me to, because I am dying in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Clancy started giving me some directions to take. And the funny thing is that he didn't ask me to do anything. that I wasn't already doing. The difference is that those directions were coming from somebody other than myself, and I was now accountable to another human being for my actions, and my life started to change just a little bit at a time. And I wanted to move back down to Los Angeles because I wanted to run, and Clancy told me that I needed to stay in Northern California, that I couldn't yank that little boy out of school. I needed to leave him right where he was and let him graduate with his friends, that he had lost enough. And I was angry about that direction, but I did as I was asked. And after Dylan graduated from school, my kids were throwing these Animal House, like, rager frat parties in my home. And I told Clancy, he goes, if they do it again, like, move. You can come now. And they did it again, and I packed up my house 30 days later, and I moved to Southern California. My kids both rented rooms. They were drinking and getting loaded. Matthew came home from Iraq with a little bit of post-traumatic stress, and he spent the next 5 years with a little recreational black tar heroin habit trying to, like, medicate himself. And he's homeless on the streets of Santa Barbara. I can't get a hold of my kid, and it's just an absolute nightmare. And I leave both of those little boys up, well, those young men up in Hollister, and I move down to Los Angeles. And a couple months later, my youngest guy called me up. He's like, I'm couch surfing. I can't do it anymore. Can I come home? And I put him on a bus. I took him up to the Mountain High Conference, which is a conference that my home group has on Mother's Day weekend. I picked him up on Friday. We went straight up the mountain, and I watched the young men in my home group surround my son. And they did what you guys do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I stepped way back, and I watched, and Dylan had, we played games. We played softball and volleyball and all of these things, and Dylan got to hang out with Polly Pistol, who he's known since he was a baby. I love Polly, and we came back down the hill. I introduced my son to my hero in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of my sobriety brothers. He's the closest thing to a brother that I've ever known in my life. His name was Sergeant Major Franklin Dennis Jones. And he's a caisson sniper, badass Marine, like, woo, I love that guy. And Dylan comes home and he's like, oh, he is amazing, and I want to be just like him. I'm going to join the Marine Corps. And my brother mentored my child, and Dylan went into the Marine Corps. He spent 4.5 years in there. He's lead rifle inspector of the silent drill platoon in Washington, D.C. If you ever go to a professional football game and there's 26 Marines standing at the 50-yard line spinning their rifles in their dress blue uniform, that was my baby. Like, I got to watch him do that. And he just got out of the Marine Corps. He's living in Northern California with his fiance, going to school on his GI Bill, and I'm so proud of that young man. He was a nightmare. I thought I was going to have to give him to Narcotics Anonymous. And one day he just, like, decided, okay, I've had enough. Like, I'm done with this. And I do not get that mentality, but he's one of those guys. Like, given sufficient reason, we just cut that stuff out. And he is a fine young man. He just turned 25 years old, and I love him. Oh, my God, I love him. And that little PTSD guy followed his brother not long after that. He called me up homeless in Northern California with no money and a broke-down truck. And since it worked so well the first time, I picked up that young man, and I took him up on a camping trip with my home group. The young men in my group did what the young men in my group do. And August 29th of this year, I got to give my son his 2-year cake. And every single day for 5 years, you guys, my prayer was, oh, God, please don't make me bury my child. I don't think I can. And I know I can because I've watched you guys do it, but I just don't think I can. And those boys have taught me so much, you guys. I remember fighting this concept of God at years sober, and I'm fighting the idea. Because the truth is, if I really believe that there's a loving and powerful Father that wants nothing but the best for me, it's almost incumbent upon me, isn't it, to turn my will and my life over to the care of that power. And sometimes I don't want to. And so I'm fighting the concept of God. My kids are getting in all, bless you, my kids are getting in all this trouble, and I'm looking at them, and I'm thinking, like, I love you guys more than life itself. I would do anything for you. Like, I want to protect you from harm, and I want to make sure that you have absolutely every possibility in your life that your little heart can dream of. And it doesn't matter what you do, no matter how egregious your mistakes are, I just love you. And there is nothing that you can do that will diminish that. And then I thought, like, you guys tell me that this God might be my loving father. And what if this loving father loves me just as fiercely and unconditionally and protectively and completely as I love my children? And my whole fight went away. It seems to me over the course of 32 years in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have surrendered and I have surrendered and I have surrendered. Like, I have this big white flag and I tear off the smallest piece possible and throw it in and hide the rest of it because I want to hang on to this part. And then later, incrementally, I surrender some more, and I might surrender my career, I might surrender my this, my car, my money, my whatever, but I want to hang on to my children, and I want to hang on to my relationship, and it's been my experience that absolutely everything that I have been unwilling to surrender, absolutely everything that I place between me and Alcoholics Anonymous has been removed from me. And that's so important for me to recognize and to remember that anything that I place before Alcoholics Anonymous has got to go. And I love this thing. I love this thing. And it seems when Matthew got sober, so I'm 32 years sober. I live in a little two-bedroom apartment. My 29-year-old is my roommate. My life wasn't supposed to look like this, but it is the way that it is, and it seems to be at this particular moment completely all right with me, and I thought, to the best of my ability, that I had surrendered it all, that I had thrown it all in, like money, husband, whatever, what I have is what I have, what I don't have is what I don't have, and I am in love with my life in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wake up every morning and I feel like a kid in a candy store, And a couple weeks ago, I went in and I saw my esthetician, and she's like, "Oh, honey, you need to go to the doctor." And so I'm leaving. I go, yeah. And she goes, "No, I'm not even kidding, honey." And so I call my doctor. I'm like, "She's just being ridiculous, but I need to come in." And the next day, I was at the other doctor, and 2 days later, they're cutting, and 2 days later, it's malignant, and now we're cutting more, and there's all of this stuff. There's all of this stuff going on. And I was diagnosed a week and a half ago, right about there, with a malignant melanoma. They cut it, and there's no clear margin, so I'm going to go back, and we're going to cut some more. And we're going to take out some lymph nodes because I have some funny symptoms that I shouldn't be having. And I thought that I was all in. I thought that I had absolutely surrendered everything that there is to surrender. But the truth of the matter is that it's an incremental deal for me. And so this is what's next, right? And I am going to walk through this with the largest amount of grace and dignity that I could possibly muster. And when I fail at that, as I do so often, I know that you guys are going to be okay with it and you're going to carry me through when I can't. Two minutes and I'll sit. So, probably. I started at 9, so I'm good, right? No, that wasn't rhetorical. I mean, like, right? I'll just tell you this one little story because this is how I end all of my talks. I told you about this incredible fight that I have with this God of my own understanding. And over the course of my sobriety, I've grown in understanding and effectiveness, and my relationship with this power has become incredible. It has become incredible. But when I was 13 years sober, I was at the cusp of coming to believe or being willing to, and I was on this cruise ship. It was the night of my 13th birthday, and my husband and I were sailing down to Ensenada for a little cruise, whatever. And I was dressed in this lacy gown, and my hair was made up, and I had my makeup on, and it was the night of my birthday. It was Saturday night, and Chris and I had had dinner at the captain's table. And then Chris went into the casino, and I went downstairs to the Friends of Bill meeting because I wanted to celebrate 13 years, and nobody was there. And I went up, and I was standing on the deck of this cruise ship, and it was the most surreal, beautiful night that I can remember in my entire life. There was a full moon, and there were all of these wispy clouds, and the moon was peeking out from behind the clouds, and there were like a million stars. And it looked like every single one of the white caps coming off the ship had a light underneath it, and it was just magical. And I was standing on the deck of the cruise ship, and I was talking to all my old-timers. What happens when you get sober at a club full of old-timers? They pass away at a fairly rapid clip. And I was standing on the deck of that cruise ship, and I was communing with all my old-timers. And I was telling them, oh, my God, you guys, whoever would have thought that I would have a life like this. And just like they were all standing on the deck of that cruise ship with me, I could hear them all say, we did, baby girl. I know that Paul Mattson looked at me on the 10th day of October in 1984, and he saw a sober and dignified woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that my mama Helen looked at this little homeless girl and she saw a mother. And I know that Frank and Francie Priest looked at me and they saw a wife. And my friends Mike and Norma Ensign looked at me and they saw a daughter. Like, you guys looked at me, foul-mouthed and smelly and broken and homeless. And you saw these amazing possibilities in a drunken little girl. And I believe that you breathed every single thing that I am into my very being. I think that you guys created me from nothing. And standing on the deck of that cruise ship, I realized what happened, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I do very clearly now. I realized that the God of Alcoholics Anonymous came to me in the only way that he knew that I could have him, and it was through you guys. I'd like to say that that's not the case today, but oftentimes it still is. There's a whole chapter in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that's entitled We Agnostics. And I used to believe that if I said that I was agnostic, that what that meant is that I didn't believe in God, which is not the case. Our big book says that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And so if I go up through the course of my day and at any moment in that day I doubt myself, it means that I doubt the God within me. And in that moment, I am agnostic. What agnostic means, A means without, and Gnostic means connection with or access to the power. So if I tell you that I am agnostic for a moment or for a day, it means that I am without access to or connection with that power. And throughout the course of every day, I have those moments. I have those moments when I can't access the power. And in those times, I need do nothing more than walk into the center of Alcoholics Anonymous and look at you, and that doubt and that lack of connection goes away for me. My friend Bill says oftentimes that God exists in the space between me and you. And when I can't access God, I can come in here and I can always see him in reflected back in your eyes. I love this deal. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to promise you that you can have anything that you want to have, and you can become anything that you want to become. You can be anything and do anything that you want to do if you just stay in here with us and you do the silly, mundane, ridiculous things that seem to have no bearing whatsoever to the problems going on in your life. You just do these things and you put Alcoholics Anonymous first, and everything else will just take care of itself. And I have to tell you guys that if I live to be 100 years old and I do nothing but serve you every single day for the rest of my life, I could never, ever repay you for the gifts that you've given me. But I promise you I'll spend the rest of my life trying. Thank you so much for having me.